6. Blood and Smoke. Mirabeau Bonaparte Lamar was a poet. His best-known works, they were apparently popular in certain literary corners of 19th-century America, were Thou Idol of My Soul and An Evening on the Banks of the Chattahoochee. He was also an expert fencer, a superb horseman, an amateur historian, and an oil painter of some accomplishment and sensibility. When he was elected president of the sovereign nation known as the Republic of Texas in 1838, his critics derided him for making a better poet than president. That may or may not have been true, but the one thing everyone could agree on in that violent and unsettled year was that he was, even by frontier standards, a dangerous, mean, and uncompromising son of a bitch. There is a famous photograph of him from sometime in the 1840s in which he looks less like a poet than a button man for the mob. His arms are crossed defiantly and defensively, enhancing the wrinkles in an already deeply creased broadcloth suit. His hair, swept back from his forehead, looks like it needs washing and combing. He has pale, vacant, killer eyes, and thin lips are curled ever so slightly back into something that looks like the beginning of a snarl. It is unclear just how the poet and painter came to be housed in the body of a truculent Indian annihilator and would-be empire builder. He owed his elevation to the presidency both to his heroism at the Battle of San Jacinto. His rescue of two fellow soldiers was so breathtakingly brave that it drew a salute from enemy lines, and to the utter failure of his predecessor, the brilliant alcoholic statesman Sam Houston, to solve the Indian problem. In the years since San Jacinto and the raid at Parker's Fort, white men had been pouring into Texas by the thousands, crashing headlong into the eastern boundary lands of Comancheria, and as a result, the frontier had exploded in violence, most of it at the hands of the Comanches. Houston had taken a conciliatory approach. He refused to implement congressional troop authorizations. He refused to authorize frontier forts. He had spent time with Indians, both as an agent and as the ambassador for the Cherokee Nation in Washington. He liked them and believed he understood them. He often sided with them, and he invariably defended their right to territory. When a Comanche chief asked him to set a boundary on white settlement, he answered in frustration, "If I could build a wall from the Red River to the Rio Grande, so high that no Indian could scale it, the white people would go crazy trying to devise a means to get beyond it." He had held peace talks with Comanches, without result. Meanwhile, the settlers rushed in like a moon tide from the east, bearing their ingenious instruments that stole the land, and spurred on by the Texas Congress's opening of all Indian lands to white settlement, over Houston's veto. As homesteads crept up the valleys of the Colorado, Guadalupe, and Brazos rivers, Comanche attacks escalated. In just the first 2 years of Houston's administration, more than 100 captives were carried off. Most, like little 9-year-old Cynthia Ann Parker, were simply heartbreakingly gone. There was no appeal to the government, no redress, just wrenching, empty grief for hundreds of families who could not know the fate of their loved ones in the high, windy plains of Comancheria. After the raid at Parker's Fort, Cynthia Ann's uncle and Rachel's father, James, had pleaded on two occasions with Sam Houston to finance a rescue expedition to retrieve the five hostages. Houston had turned him down flat. There was violent death everywhere along the bleeding edge of this westernmost frontier, a great deal more than history ever recorded, and Houston could not afford to throw his scant resources at the rescue of one set of captives, however touching their story. By late 1838, the new republic had reached a boiling point, and just at that moment, Mirabeau Bonaparte Lamar was elected president. The hard-edged Lamar was the perfect counterpoint to the measured diplomatic Houston, whom he despised as much as he hated the new city on the bayou in East Texas that bore his name. One of Lamar's first acts was to move the capital from the swamps of East Texas 150 miles west to a new town named Austin at the very foot of the Balcones Escarpment, in other words, right up against the edge of Comanche country. The move westward was in keeping with the views of this pro-slavery fire-eater who wanted nothing to do with union with the United States. His dream was to push the borders of his young republic all the way to the golden shores of the Pacific Ocean. Austin would be at the confluence of key western trade routes, a sort of Constantinople of the primitive West, the seat of a sprawling empire called Texas that would vie for continental supremacy with the agglomeration of eastern states known as the United States of America. Though the majority of Texans had expected that they would be annexed almost instantly by the United States after their victory at San Jacinto, Lamar had plenty of fellow dreamers. One of them was James Parker, father to Rachel and uncle to Cynthia Ann, who proposed to the Congress that he lead 4,000 men gloriously to capture Santa Fe in New Mexico, and that each of the men be given 360 acres as a reward. Congress declined to approve the plan. In spite of an empty treasury and currency that was almost worthless, Lamar saw no reason why he could not build his empire of the West. The first step, of course, was getting rid of the Indians. He believed that Indians should be either expunged from Texas or killed outright. This included all Indians, from the Comanches on the west to the Wacos in the middle and the Shawnees and Delawares and Cherokees in the east. In his inaugural address, he put this quite succinctly, in case anyone was not clear about where he stood. Citing the Indians' cruelties, he called for an exterminating war against them that would admit of no compromise and have no termination except in their total extinction or total expulsion. The Congress of the Republic of Texas heartily agreed. That month, they voted to create an 840-man regiment of 50 companies to serve for 3 years. They also voted a $1 million appropriation. Thus Lamar's rallying cry, "Extinction or expulsion." It sounds a good deal like a public appeal for genocide, certainly among the very few in modern history. But as appalling as it might sound, in fact, Lamar, a man who had experience with Creek Indians in Georgia, was just being brutally candid in a way that almost no white man had ever been on the subject of Indian rights. His was a policy of naked aggression, as usual, but without the usual hypocrisy. He demanded the Indians' complete submission to the Texans' terms, there would be no endless renegotiation of meaningless boundaries, and stated quite clearly what would happen to them if they did not agree. He proposed nothing and presided over nothing that was not already fully established in Anglo-American precedent and policy, wrote historian T.R. Fehrenbach. The people and the courts had decided that true peace between white men and red men was impossible unless either the Indians gave up their world or the Americans eschewed the nation they were determined to erect upon this continent. Since 200 years of duplicity and bloodshed had proved that neither of those things would ever happen, Lamar was just stating what was to him obvious. What he had done that no high-ranking government official in the neighboring United States of America had ever done before was to explicitly deny that Indians in Texas had rights to any territory at all. Every treaty ever signed assumed that Indians would get at least some land on their terms. Indeed, in 1825, the U.S. government had created an Indian country, modern Oklahoma, in order to guarantee that, in the words of Secretary of War James Barber, the future residents of these peoples will be forever undisturbed. Lamar and most of the residents of their new sovereign nation opposed the very principle. In some sense, what he proposed was better than the piecemeal destruction that had been meted out to the eastern tribes. In another sense, it was an invitation to the outright slaughter of native peoples. The Texas Congress loved the new Indian policy. In 1839, 2,000 revved-up, patriotic, adventure-hungry Texans signed up to fight Indians. And fight them they did. The upshot of the Lamar presidency was an almost immediate war against all Indians in Texas. The summer of 1839 witnessed one of the most savage campaigns ever unleashed against Native Americans. The first target was the Cherokees, who had been pushed relentlessly westward over many decades from their homelands in the Carolinas. Many had landed in the piney woods and sandy riverbanks of East Texas, near the Louisiana border, where they had largely lived in peace with whites for almost 20 years. They were one of the five civilized tribes, and were indeed quickly absorbing the white man's culture, dressing like whites, farming or running businesses, speaking English. The excuse for getting rid of them was a trumped-up charge that they were part of a Mexican-backed plot to drive the whites from Texas. It was almost certainly false, but it was all that Lamar and his Secretary of War needed. Faced with the demand for his immediate departure from the state, Chief Bowles of the Cherokees agreed to leave if the government compensated his tribe for improvements they had made on the land. The Texans agreed in principle, but offered little, and talk soon broke down. Then, by plan, the soldiers moved in. 900 of them. On July 15, 1839, they attacked a Cherokee village. On July 16, they cornered 500 Cherokees in a dense thicket and swamp and proceeded to kill most of the men, including Chief Bowles. 2 days later, the soldiers burned their villages, homes, and fields. The war was just beginning. Flush with his victory over the Cherokees, Texas Commander Kelsey Douglas requested permission to clean out the rat's nest of other mostly peaceful tribes in East Texas. Now there was more killing and more fire. By the end of July, the cornfields and villages of all the Cherokees, Delawares, Shawnees, Caddoans, Kickapoos, Creeks, Muscogees, and Seminoles in East Texas were burned to the ground. Their innocence was beside the point. Whether a particular murder was committed by a Kiowa, Caddo, Wichita, or Creek seemed to Texans to make less and less difference. Most of the dispossessed Indians took their ragged, starving families and headed north to the designated Indian Territory, where some 20,000 officially relocated Indians now jostled with each other and with the native Plains tribes, the last stop on what came to be known as the Trail of Tears. Some of the Cherokees, including Chief Bowles' son, tried to flee to Mexico. As though to make sure there was absolutely no misunderstanding at all about the new Indian policies, the Texans hunted them down over several hundred miles and shot them, then took their women and children prisoner. Only two tribes, the Alabamas and the Cushatas, were permitted to stay, though they were moved from their own fertile fields to much less desirable lands. Thus were tens of thousands of acres of superb farmland in East Texas open to white farmers, who immediately, happily, and presumably with immaculately clean consciences, moved in. Those were the sedentary, somewhat civilized, relatively non-warlike, beaten-down, relocated, unmounted, agrarian Indians of East Texas, anyway. There were other sedentary tribes who lived beyond the frontier and were thus safe for the moment from this cleansing by fire. Wichitas, Wacos, Tawakonees, Kichais, Tonkawas, and a few others. But while it might be entertaining and rewarding to massacre and exile the relatively harmless and broken Muscogees and Seminoles, the real trouble, most of the depredations, came not from the east, but from the west. Everyone knew it. For all of their bravado and puffed-up war talk and insatiable greed for new territory, there was very little the Texans could do in the immense expanse of land constituting most of Texas itself that was ruled by the Comanches. To understand their dilemma, look at a map of modern Texas. Draw a line from San Antonio through Austin and Waco, ending at Dallas at the forks of the Trinity River. That is roughly the western, meaning Comanche, frontier, as it existed in the late 1830s, though there was very little settlement near present-day Dallas. Most of it was spread around Austin and San Antonio. That line also follows the 98th meridian almost exactly, meaning that this is where the trees start to thin out. By the 100th meridian, in the neighborhood of modern Abilene, they are mostly gone. In the region of Austin and San Antonio, it marks the edge of the Balcones Escarpment, a fault zone where the big rolling timbered limestone hills rose from the fertile coastal plain. They rose so abruptly that their stone ramparts reminded the Spanish of balconies in a theater, hence the name. Piercing this line at three points were the Brazos, Colorado, and Guadalupe Rivers. Imagine them as raiders' highways, sweeping down the state from the northwest, aimed directly at the heart of the Texas frontier. These rivers were also, of course, highways into the uplands of Comancheria, for anyone brave or stupid enough to ascend them. The problem was that, to the west of the line, from a white man's perspective, there was a vast, mysterious, frightening, bone-dry world inhabited by a fierce and primitive people who could outride, outshoot, and outtrack them, and who could navigate enormous distances with alarming ease. The Indians fought mounted, too, which put the Westerners, with their heavy horses, their practice of fighting on foot, and their cumbersome muzzle-loading rifles, at a huge disadvantage. Because the Indians did not have permanent villages, they were usually impossible to locate. If you located them, you were likely to wish you hadn't. That did not stop the Texans from trying. In those early years of the Republic, a motley assortment of militias, ranger companies, volunteers, and state companies trooped out regularly after Comanches following raids. They killed some Comanches, and they got lucky a few times, but mostly they did not. Mostly they were schooled by the superior Indians in plains warfare, and many of them died hard and lingering deaths. More than the Texans ever cared to admit.